Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Mary Sparrowdancer, and she has a book out called Love Song of the Universe, which we're going to discuss. I have read it today, so the facts of it are very clear and present in my mind, and I can tell you it's a wonderful book, terrifically interesting, and I should think Mary, in her life so far, has had enough experiences for everyone on the planet, so I'm expecting to have a very interesting chat with her. What can we tell you about her just before she comes on? She's a writer, researcher, independent journalist, and she's a frequent radio guest because of the story she has to tell. So I think that's a good enough introduction, Mary. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Yes, well, I wasn't making any exaggeration when I said about the things that happened in your life, and I really think how on earth did you sort of cope with it, because you've had things happen to you that normally people wouldn't expect or only have at times in isolation. Now, when did you have your first experiences of anything psychic or unusual? Because I think your book starts at when you were the age of 37 years old.
Yes, and I was fairly normal up until that time, and I was the mother of two young children and the wife of a very well known attorney here in Florida. He's actually just retired. He was the director of the Florida Bar. And so anyway, life was very normal up until the point where things began happening and there was no explanation for them. And so for the first time in my life, I was faced with witnessing and observing all sorts of events that could not be explained. And for me, it was a wonderful experience because there was a great deal of physical evidence that was being left here everywhere. There were pieces of ancient pottery that were left here, and you'd turn around and there would be white stones falling out of the air. And so this was when this began happening. My little boy was about two, and my daughter was about three and a half, and so it was so commonplace. This was part of their life, and so that they didn't question anything. So one day, when white stones were falling out of just out of the air in the living room and bouncing off the floor, my son John ran over and picked them up and said, "Oh, here, Mom, this must be for you."
I love the casual way this has all happened in your life. When it originally started, when these, shall we call them, artifacts started to arrive, didn't it sort of scare you or make you feel a bit peculiar and think, why is this happening to me?
It didn't scare me at that point. When I finally became scared was after the beings of light began showing up here, the incredibly beautiful, I guess some people would refer to them as angels. We don't really know what to call them. I've just referred to them as beings of light. When they started showing up here and started giving me information, that was okay for a while, and then I wanted it to stop. I just wanted to be normal again. And I wanted it to go away, and I wanted them, everything, to just leave me alone. I didn't want any more pottery. I didn't want any more white stones. I didn't want any more angels standing here on the doorstep. I just wanted to be left alone. And so I had a very dear friend who was a Roman Catholic priest, And I said to him, you know, how do I make this stop? And he said, you can't make it stop. It's not ever going to stop now. And I said, but there must be a way to stop it. And he said, no. And I said, well, I want my old life back. I want to just be, you know, a normal person again. And he said, you can't have your old life back. This is your life now. This is your life, and you will have to get used to it. So he told me that I would go through a period of transition that would take me maybe a couple of months, and that eventually I would come to accept that this is now my normal life.
Right. Now, that, I believe, was in 1989. So how long altogether had you been having these experiences?
Since 1987.
87, right. Mm-hmm. So you had an awful lot happening then over a relatively short period, really. And mm-hmm. I believe in the end it sort of got to you in such a way that you almost felt suicidal and had panic attacks.
No, I didn't have, I wasn't suicidal ever. And
no.
But I was having panic attacks.
Right.
And so I went to not just a psychiatrist, but I went to an entire group of psychologists, and they came over and they wanted to check the house, and they checked everything. And so the first of the psychologists who came over, they did a number of tests to determine, you know, whether I was sane or not. And the psychiatrist did his own test too. And the first group, the psychologists, after they had done their assessment, my ex-husband, wasn't able to take this. So anyway, he asked the psychologist, well, what do you think is happening here? And the psychologist said to him, my God, man, do you know what's going on here? This is the real thing. And so anyway, that didn't help my ex. And when I went back to the psychiatrist after I had taken all of his tests, I went in to find out whether he had discovered, am I sane, am I not sane, am I going to need to be hospitalized. And so when I went into his office, he was sitting at his desk, and he was weeping. And I thought, oh, this is going to be bad news. And
yes.
So he was using his own tissues that he keeps on his desk for patients when they are having a weepy moment.
Right.
And so he was weeping into his own tissues, and and so finally when he looked up, he said to me, everything that you're saying is true. He said, you're telling the truth, you're sane, and what you're saying is true. And he said, I'm hoping that you will honor me by coming in and telling me everything.
Mm.
So that began... I guess about a year, when I would go in and I would tell him everything that I had seen and heard. And,
Right. Now, I think we'd love to hear about some of your experiences, but I feel first we should explain here that really one of the key points in your life must have been the experience you had when you were 14 years old, when you were brought up as a Catholic. And I believe it was for the first time you heard from your teacher about the Spanish Inquisition. And I think that had such a severe effect, even a shock on you, that you later disassociated yourself with those type of teachings. And then you turned to Judaism, not for very long, but you took an initiation or a ceremony in a Jewish temple. And you became Miriam for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And it obviously must have been an intended point, important point in your life, because you went to a Hebrew school and must have easily learnt Hebrew, and no doubt relating to an earlier life, which must have come up in your subconscious, when you spoke it, you pronounced it as it was prior to 1948. But you soon left Judaism and became an atheist. Now, I think having gone through that and cleared your mind, if we may put it that way, you were then probably open for these new experiences. Now, would that be a fair assessment of what happened?
Oh, absolutely. That would be an extremely good assessment of what happened, because I was just there. My daughter made a very good point when she was about 14 years old. She said to me that she didn't think that I was ever actually an atheist. She thought that I just wasn't accepting the only gods available, that I was looking for something different, something more loving, something more kind than the God of the Old Testament, who says that he's the only God. But it was the learning of Hebrew that actually helped me to go through many years of research and study, in which I actually was using the Hebrew that I had learned in order to research some of the old texts. And it was in the fact that I was able to read the Hebrew myself that I was able to discover and determine that a large portion of the Old Testament has been mistranslated into English, and it says things very differently in Hebrew.
Is there a problem sometimes that when you translate it, there really isn't an appropriate word in the English language that really conveys the same impression?
Yes, I think that's one of the situations. But the thing that that really, to me, was a very great eye opener was that the very, very first line in Genesis, there is a reference not to God but the gods, Elohim.
Yes,
gods.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's a plural word, no matter how you want to try to explain it away. We are not talking about one God. We are talking about gods. And in reading all of Genesis, it appears that there was one group of Elohim that were very they were very loving and very kind to the humans. And then there arrived a different group of Elohim, and those were the slave masters. Ones, they're very different, completely different. And it was after the arrival of the second group that we begin hearing from the one who is actually named, however anyone may wish to pronounce it, many people say Jehovah.
Yes.
And so anyway, we find that the teachings from these different groups of gods are completely at odds. We're told by one group, the first group that was kind and nice to us, that we're supposed to partake of every sort of plant that's bearing seeds. And the second group is going to cast us forever out of Eden if we dare look at, if we dare touch certain plants. They don't want us touching, partaking of everything. They want some of the things forbidden. So we've got different different values and different teachings. And this is one of the reasons why I think that the Bible can be very difficult to understand, because there are completely different teachings in it.
Yes, I totally agree with you. And it's quite easy to look back into ancient history. Take the Egyptians, for example, where they had a whole multitude of different gods and beliefs. The Sumerians were very much the same. So there's nothing I feel unusual about the reference of the olden times talking about more than one god. Now, tell our listeners, at what point in your life did the American Indians come into it? Because they feature very much through the whole of your experiences. Mm-hmm. So where did it sort of first happen for you?
I began becoming aware of all of the pottery that was being left here on the kitchen shelves and on coffee tables and whatever. So at around the same time that all of my pottery was appearing here, and there was a state archaeologist who was excavating a site just a couple of blocks away from my house, and his name was Calvin Jones. And so I gathered up some of the pieces of my pottery, and I went over to his site and asked him if he could identify the pottery that I was holding in my hands. And he said, oh, yes, these are from the 1500s. And he said, where did you find them? And I said, around my house. And so he said, well, yep, you must be living on one of the alternate sites of De Soto's first encampment here in Tallahassee. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't really impressed.
He thought you were pulling his leg.
Right, he didn't know that. He didn't know that I was finding it in my kitchen cabinets and everything. But yeah. He was such a very nice man, but it was from around the 1500s, and when I began realizing that, I started, you know, paying closer attention to some of the history, and what did De Soto actually do? What actually did happen when De Soto came to town? And and then I found out what happened was he came to town and he took the village in the dead of winter away from the local Indians or Native Americans. And the winters in Tallahassee are, I have to say, brutal. It was 20 mm-hmm. degrees here last night. And and it's it was with the wind chill factor 2 weeks ago, it was 8. And so, you know, we have very, very cold winters here. And so it would be a hardship for someone to be deprived of their home here in Tallahassee during the winter. But
right.
I became more aware of the Indians, and I think they were just more or less waiting for us to open the door to them. Because I don't think they ever, those in the spirit world, if they are trying to make contact with someone, they don't do it in a way that's going to terrify them. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was my children and I could see the Indians standing out in the front yard, but my ex, all he could see was swamp gas. So, while the kids and I were looking at, we were looking at all of these Indians, and at one point there were thousands of them gathered right outside the white picket fence. They were standing in the street. They were in the driveway. They were everywhere. And that was when the major meeting occurred. And it was my daughter Emily who first opened the door to them, and And I would like to mention my daughter, Emily, is now a deputy sheriff, and my son, John, my son John, just ran a very successful campaign for Florida Senate. He just about became a Florida senator.
Right. Oh, well, well done. Now, you're talking about Emily, and she does figure quite a lot in your stories. And I must comment on what you just said first, though. I love the idea of one comment you made where you said there were thousands of these Indians in your yard. I'm trying to imagine how big your yard must be to get thousands of Indians in it. But never mind. Tell us a story about Emily when she was 4 years old. Mm-hmm. And she was talking to a lady, and all you could hear was the conversation and Emily coming backwards and forwards and looking for cookies and milk. Now, that's a very, very nice story. Tell us about that one.
All right. Well, I was fixing lunch for the children and myself. So I was in the kitchen, and we have this is a large yard here. It's actually, I have two lots, and the whole thing is completely fenced in. So anyway, I was in the kitchen, I was making lunch, and I could hear Emily talking at the front door. And so, as you mentioned, she came back into the kitchen where I was, and she was asking for cookies and stuff like that. And I said, well, Emily, you know you can't have cookies right now. We're getting ready to have lunch. And she said, well, they're not for me. They're for the lady at the front door. And I said, what lady at the front door? And she said, the lady standing at the front door. She wanted to know if we had something to eat. And so I said, well, just a minute, because immediately I was concerned because you can't really get into the yard here because the whole thing is fenced in. So I dried my hands and I started around into the foyer. And when I rounded the corner, Emily started screaming, no, 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 don't go away. And so I got up to the front door and I could not see anything out there. There was no one out there. And I said to her, Emily, don't tell me to come to the door when there's no one really there. And she said, but there was someone there. And so I just went back into the kitchen, and she followed me back into the kitchen, and she said, the lady knew my name. And I said, She said, hello, Emily, darling. Do you have food? And this question can be taken two different ways. It can be taken as an offering of food to Emily or an asking for food of Emily.
Right.
So anyway, when Emily began describing the lady, we had been having so many encounters with Indians. I was thinking, okay, well, this is completely out of her imagination, and she's probably going to now tell me about that this was an Indian lady standing there.
Yes.
So she began telling me that how the lady was so beautiful. And the sun was shining on her everywhere. And she said, the sun was shining so brightly, it turned the sky yellow. And I said, right. Mm-hmm. And she said, and the lady, she was just completely bathed with this yellow light. It was all shining on her. And I said, mm-hmm. And I said, and did this lady have a dress on? And I was assuming that she was going to tell me she was wearing a buckskin dress. And Emily said, yes, she was wearing a long, long blue dress. It came all the way down to her feet. And I said, blue? And she said, yes, the lady was dressed in blue. And she said, except she was wearing a long belt of yellow roses.
Mm.
And
what about her shoes?
Pardon? Right.
What about her shoes?
Right. And I said, was she wearing shoes? And Emily said, yes, she was wearing blue tennis shoes.
I love that story. I think that's beautiful, yes. And while you're talking about yellow roses, it's a logical place to move on to your lovely rose bush. Tell us what happened there.
Well, that afternoon, the rose bush that had been there since before I ever owned this house, it was a rose bush of climbing red roses. And it had been, you know, it was blooming at this particular time of the year, so it had been, you know, filled with its red blooms. And that afternoon, after the lady visited here, I went out on the front porch, and the roses had become yellow peace roses with a slight touch of pink in the inside. So they had just... That was the beginning when I was thinking, oh, we really don't know what's going on here. And
am I correct in saying, in fact, that the colors never changed back to red? It stayed as a yellow color.
Yes, it did. It stayed yellow, and I went running for the camcorder to record this. And when my ex got home from work, you know, I showed it to him, and he said, oh, they were probably always yellow, and you just never noticed.
I think that's a natural answer when someone
doesn't
he
was
really
trying
to
do
say,
anything.
I believe it. Yeah.
Right.
Now, we can't finish with Emily here at the moment, because I gather that the Indians came back again, and she, on that occasion, she did feed them cookies and milk. Now, can we make it clear here? She's actually seeing things that, apart from yourself possibly, other people wouldn't see, but they were real to her, obviously.
Yes, they were real to her. They were real to John, and they became very real to me. And one of my other close friends happened to be a medicine man, and they were very real to him. He could see them. So only at one point we had the medicine man, his wife, Craig, my ex, who was a lawyer, and one of his friends who was also a lawyer. We were all sitting in the front yard, and I was there too. We were all sitting in lawn chairs in the front yard one evening watching the Indians, and only the medicine man, his wife, and I could see them.
Oh, right.
And the two lawyers could not see them.
Hmm.
So it was incredible, because not only were we seeing them, but we were verifying what we were seeing with one another. Are you seeing this one standing here? And we could, you know, we were all seeing the same thing.
Right. Now, your life, as you started to get these experiences, became more, in a way, bizarre, because you started seeing spheres of different colors. Sometimes a person would sort of emerge from it. And it would seem to me, the way you write, that these didn't seem to cause you any difficulty. It was as though you accepted these quite naturally. But tell us one or two of your stories connected with what happened when these spheres appeared to you, and mainly in the evening or during the night.
Yes, they would wake me up. And I guess the very first time I was visited by a sphere was in was September 11th, 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just been diagnosed with cancer, And the cancer, they were going to do surgery on my face that was going to leave me, devastated as far as my physical appearance went. And so I was in like a very deep state of depression on that night. And at some point, and I'm not certain of the exact time, but I was awakened by a bright light shining in my face. And when I opened my eyes, I could see a very large sphere of light, at least 6 feet in diameter, that was in my bedroom several feet away from me. And so it as the light was more or less swirling around and around, the sphere was, and light was coming out of it, and it had a very, very pleasant, tranquil effect, and it just a very soothing and calming effect. And so as I was looking at it, I was just feeling this wonderful sense of being calm and being actually feeling happy, even though this had been one of the worst days I could remember. And so I was just looking at it, and it was calming me. And then a man spoke from within the light, and he said, "You're not afraid, are you?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Good. None of this is supposed to be frightening to you. You're not supposed to be afraid of any of this." And so he talked for a while, and I didn't have any idea who this was. I'm assuming, coming from what I was thinking was an atheist point of view, I am assuming that this is somebody from another planet who has somehow found me in Tallahassee. Yes. And so we talked for a while, and then he asked me a few questions, and I answered his questions to the best of my ability. And he said, "How come you people never pray?" And I said, "Oh, we pray all the time. it doesn't do any good." And he said, "Well, how do you pray?" And I said, "Well, we memorize words and we repeat them over and over again." And so anyway, at this point, he began this sphere of light. He began glowing brighter, very, very, very bright, so bright that it was just incredible. It was beyond description. And so as bright as he was, he then sent he said to me, he sent a beam of light at me that hit me, and I was just overwhelmed with this feeling of complete love. And yes. he said, "Now think of your worst enemy." And so I did. I thought of the worst enemy I could think of, and he said, "Now send what you're feeling to her." So right. I did. I sent what I was feeling to her, and when I did that, everything I sent to her came back to me again, and it went back to him again. And so it was just extraordinary. And I have never felt love like this. And he said, "Now, you've just prayed for the first time in your life. Prayer is a love song."
Right.
You have forgotten. That's,
mm-hmm. Yeah, pardon? That's a beautiful, beautiful story. I love that one. When you said you sent the love out to her, and then it came back to you and on to him, do you take it that it was the same love that you sent out? Or it sounds as though when it came back to you, it sort of increased 100-fold.
I think it did. I think it did. I was not, after that particular moment when it all came back to me, everything that I sent out all came back 100-fold. I think that was the first moment in my life that I became absolutely unafraid to love. And the more I understood this, that love is the most important thing for us all. The more I understood that, the more it was reinforced by everything around me, absolutely everything. And at one point, as soon as what I had sent out was sent back to me and him, and it really knocked me almost unconscious. And when I opened my eyes again, now I could see the man who was talking to me. It was no longer just a sphere of light. It was this handsome man standing there. I was able to see him for the first time.
Right. Do you think that sometimes when people have difficulty in expressing love, it's because they've been hurt very badly and they're frightened they may be hurt again?
Oh, yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Right. Okay, we'll leave that one there. Now, what happened when you became a dream walker?
That gave me some difficulties, because what would happen was I would sometimes go visit the places that I would later actually visit in my waking state. And this, having the deja vu of recognizing everything around me when this began happening, I was convinced that I was about to die.
And, yes.
It was so strange, and I think the first time that it happened, Craig and I were going on one of our last vacations, and we were somewhere in the Carolinas, and all of a sudden I began recognizing everything around us, and I realized I had just dreamed of this the night before. So I shouted, I grabbed the dashboard, and I shouted, and I said, stop the car, stop the car. We were on the, on the interstate. And so he's saying, what's the matter? What's going on? And I said, stop the car. I think I'm dying. So he started slowing down, and he slowed down. We were approaching the summit of a hill, and he said, what is the matter with you? And I said, there's a truck on the other side of this hill, and it's jackknifed, and it's blocking the traffic off, and you need to slow way down. So he slowed the car down, but was looking at me like I had finally completely lost it completely. So anyway,
yes.
We get to the other side of the hill, and there is the truck jackknifed in the middle of the highway, and the rescue teams had not arrived yet. And so this was like confirmation that his worst fears were all coming true. This was really happening, and there wasn't anything that anyone could do about it. I wasn't any longer just simply the simple housewife I had once been. So,
of course, you've since found out that so many people are psychic and have these premonitions. So you can say it was quite normal, wasn't it, really?
Yes, and actually, that was when I went out and I visited the Hopis. Because
yes.
I was hoping that they would be able to explain something to me about what was happening. And they said, well, it's all normal. And I said, how can this be normal? And they said, well, the way we see it, if it's happening, it must be normal.
Yes. Very, very simple and quite clever explanation,
right.
Yes.
Right. And yes, all of this actually was normal. I just hadn't been aware of it before.
I was going to say, what I liked in parts that came up in your book were the teachings you had from your teacher. And one or two were very, I think, hard-hitting and right to the point. For example, he evidently gave you a talk about cause and effect, and I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand. They blame everybody outside of them for things that happen in their life without realizing that they're actually the root of the problem. But when you were given a talk about that, were you given any examples of how it operates?
Yes, and people began coming to me and asking me to do healings on them, and that was a time when I truly began studying in depth the cause and effect, because everything that they were coming to me asking me to heal had a cause, and sometimes the things were, they were causing their problems themselves. One woman came to me and she said, I have an overactive bladder. And she said that she needed to visit the ladies' room, you know, 20 or 30 times a day.
Gosh.
And yes, and she said it was crippling her life. She had to be in close proximity to a facility.
Yes.
So anyway, while she was sitting here talking to me, I noticed, you know, I was just kind of watching what was going on, and I was listening to her, and she was very distraught over this. But in the meantime, she drank over a quart and a half of water.
Gosh.
She was just sitting here and drinking it and drinking it and drinking it. And so, you know, and then immediately, of course, she had to go use my bathroom.
Right.
So when she came back, I said, then she went and filled her enormous water cup back up to the top again and began drinking it again. So I said, you know, if you didn't drink this much water, you wouldn't be needing to go to the bathroom so frequently. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, well, but I have to drink this water. I have to drink it. And I said, well, why? And she said, because it's good for you. And I said, well, I would suggest that you cut back on the water intake, and then that should heal your problems. And she became angry, and she said, I don't want that type of a healing. I want you to just heal it yourself, you know. And so this was like, this was sometimes what they would, what the people would ask me to do would be to heal them so that they would have an outside healing, but they could continue on with whatever their habits were that they were, you know, that was actually causing the problems. So I became very, very much aware of cause and effect, and then I still am, and I have done a great deal of I've spent the last over 20 years studying, and there is cause and effect, and when you start tracing back, when you have a certain ailment or illness, and you start looking at everything involved, the whole big picture, if you are careful, you can find the cause of it. You can find what actually caused it. And,
right.
And the people.
Now, Mary, the time is flying by. There's no panic yet. We've got about another 7 or 8 minutes, and I do want you during that time to tell us in that time, maybe less if you can do it, about your search for God and the conclusion you came to and where you found God in the end.
Well, here's what I actually found was that I don't think we understand what there. I think that there is a difference there, that some of the beings and entities who are very, very powerful and very capable of working miracles. We have called them gods, and I think that there is also consciousness within the universe, and the consciousness which helps to bring that helps to bring the laws of physics and keep the universe from being in an utter state of chaos. There is a consciousness that does that. There is a consciousness that that takes everything that is in a proper state and turns it into chaos.
Right.
So I think that we don't really, at this particular point, we don't really understand what the word gods means. And the Egyptians were just simply referring to the beautiful, brilliant visitors as the Nedjeru. And, of course, there's no actual spelling for that because it's a phonetic description, Nedjeru. But it is interesting that there is a Hebrew word, and it is spelled the way that sounds, and it can be found in the Old Testament. And the word is translated into English as the watchers.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so some people were afraid of the watchers because they were going to come and make a judgment against some of the goings on. But so we have what I found was that I think that the consciousness is going through all of us, and it is uniting all of us if we would just understand it, that there is something keeping us, there is something that knows exactly how many times our hearts have beaten. There is
right.
something, and it's the same consciousness that knows my heart, it's the same consciousness that knows your heart, and the same
yes.
that knows the heart of every person listening.
We are one, as they say.
Yeah.
Now, you were told, well, you were taken, rather, on this quest to find God into the center of the universe, and you also ended up going into the cells of a person's body, which seemed to be another universe, and you were told that each of you are the center of your universe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a very interesting teaching that you were given there. In other words, God is, mm-hmm. as I express it, within and without.
Yes.
And it's no good really looking anywhere for him because he is everywhere. we use he
right.
as a figure of speech, of course, yeah.
Right. We need to, I don't know, I think if we're going to go on a search for God, we need to be as children and just be aware of love and aware of everything that's magical that's going on, and aware of you know, just the miracles that that might pass by us and we don't even notice them, like a caterpillar, you know, going through change and then emerging as a butterfly. Whoa, that is a major miracle.
Fantastic, I think, yes, mm-hmm. absolutely. Now, I don't know whether it would be giving away the final secret in your book to say who the man was who kept appearing to you in the light, but ultimately you learned a bit about Jesus and mm-hmm. some of the disciples.
Mm-hmm.
You asked a question about what was the Holy Grail,
mm-hmm.
and he said it was within. So you touched upon lots of different aspects, although I think
yes.
the American Indians seem to have a very great effect on your understanding.
Yes. I don't think it will give anything away at this point. that unless you don't want me to mention this, but
I think you've got such a fabulous book there. I would like everybody to be so curious to know about the rest of the story.
I am a longtime friend of the sixth generation grandson of Sitting Bull.
Yes.
And his name is Troy Fairbanks. And Troy told me that his great grandfather Sitting Bull, that when the missionaries came there to start preaching Christianity to the Indians, his grandfather said, "Oh yeah, we already know all about him. He's been here many times."
And
Sitting Bull said, "The only thing they never heard was that someone had killed him." So they had they received their teachings from Jesus Christ, and they did not understand that someone had killed him, and in fact, I don't think anyone killed him. I think he is walking among us in flesh, and he has been, and he has never left us.
That is a lovely thought. Now, we haven't asked you to give your website so that people know where to go if they are interested in purchasing your book. So perhaps you would like to give that out.
All right. Thank you. My website is sparrowdancer.com, and my last name is SparrowDancer. And at this particular point, my books are completely sold out. The first book was The Love Song of the Universe. That is sold out. My second special edition is just called The Love Song, and that is sold out. And so I will be ordering new printings very soon.
Right, that's lovely. Well, I've got to come to the end now. Unfortunately, I could have spent, I think, another 55 minutes with you. But never mind, we've touched upon some very interesting points there. And I thank you very much for coming on to my program. It's very nice indeed, and very pleasant and interesting story. So thank you very much, Mary.
Thank you. I truly enjoyed it. It was a very pleasant way to spend a portion of a Friday afternoon. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you indeed. Right, friends, yet another good guest here with an interesting story to tell, and it's real life. Next week I have Les Tindall, who likes to be known as Laserless because he believes he is the only research entity on Earth for the photo-engraved stones, that is the petrophotoglyphs, which were discovered in 1994. He says that when properly illuminated, those hologram stones called petrophotoglyphs project image codices detailing scripture. And that is what we're going to talk about. So thank you for joining me today. I hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you.